You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weiner Kent, senior editor. I'm here with
Deep Tran, associate editor.
And Susie Evans, I'm the managing editor.
And we're here on a beautiful, almost spring day in New York. Hopefully by the time you listen to this, it'll be balmy and we'll be at the beach. No, not quite. In any case, we have a good show today. We have an exit interview, if you will, with Eliza Bent, our outgoing senior editor, who started here in 2007, if I remember correctly, and will still be writing for us. You can look for her byline, but she will no longer be a regular employee at American Theater, so she'll be dearly missed. Do a lot of international coverage, downtown coverage. And she's also a playwright and actor. So anyway, I have a fun conversation with Eliza, which we'll do in a little bit. First, we want to talk about news right now. It's 'tis the season of seasons. Every theater,
all seasons, all the time.
Every theater
seasons
in America.
Of
yeah, every theater in America is either finishing up their season planning or announcing it to us, and it's going to continue. I just got an email today. About the Denver Center Theater. Their season will be announced at 4 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Their time,
6 a.m. our time. Thanks for the heads up. None of us will be
Why
up
then. Why are they announcing at 4 a.m.?
I don't know.
Man, people wake up early in Denver.
So in any case,
which outlet cares the most to get it first?
Exactly. Well, you know, we'll have it 6. If I'm up with my sons, I'll try to throw it up online. Anyway.
Now that is dedication.
Yeah, indeed. So we thought we'd, without showing any favoritism, mind you, we thought we'd let you know what seasons had come up that were of particular interest to us. And most of them are at the larger theaters, but there's some interesting stuff at some of the theaters off the beaten track you might not have heard of. Deep, did you have any ones that caught your interest in particular?
Well, I wrote up the Goodman Theater season yesterday, and they have 4 world premieres plus a new play by Rebecca Gilman, so that sounds...
I thought it was 5 world premieres.
Oh, yeah, they sent a correction today. The Rebecca Gilman play isn't actually a world premiere.
Oh, okay.
It's one of those things when you're rewriting this up really quickly, I may not have fact-checked everything the way I should have.
Okay. It's a Chicago premiere, though.
It's a Chicago premiere.
It's across town at the Steppenwolf, the new Tracy Letts play, whose name eludes me, Mary Margaret Grace or something like that, Marjorie Prime. I don't remember what it's called. It's called something or other with a woman's
Prime.
Name.
That's a
no,
Jordan
I know.
Harrison
that's a,
play.
It's got some. It's an M woman's name. Anyway,
I'm excited about that.
That looks good.
He didn't leave us for he didn't leave playwriting. That makes me happy.
No, why would he?
Probably has a lot of downtime on set on Homeland to write some plays.
Yeah, no, he's a playwright first and always will be.
Yeah. Mary Zimmerman at Berkeley Rep. And Looking Glass, her new Treasure Island.
Yeah, that looks great. And I have to say, the Amelie musical, if there's ever a movie that kind of begs to be musical, kind of was a musical, it's Amelie.
That's
one of my
favorites.
It's at Berkeley Rep also.
There's a lot of shows coming that have premiered elsewhere and that I'm a fan of as shows that are making their debuts in new cities. I mean, Jason Robert Brown is going to be conducting Bridges of Madison County, which was on our cover over at Center Theater Group, which I think will
at
be
the Amundsen.
A lot
that
fun.
Will also be at the Arkansas Rep.
Oh.
At which there will be a world premiere of a new play by someone named Scooter Peach. I don't know how you pronounce his name, directed by Jason Alexander. So, Arkansas Rep on the national scene.
Is Jason Robert Brown going to be conducting
it? I don't know
Rep?
That he'll be conducting it there. Who knows? It's possible. I don't think the dates will work out.
I'm also really excited about The Hypocrites, Pirates of Penzance, coming to Actors Theater. That'll be.
Yeah, and
that's HMS Pinafore, right?
Yeah, but it's part of their Gilbert and Sullivan Rep.
They're triangulating the entire country. Eventually, they're going to have to come to New York. They have to, right? Don't they? The Hypocrites? Come on.
I think they want to premiere something here instead of tour something here. These are all touring shows that they've done in Chicago first. Pirates has been touring forever.
But why shouldn't they tour it here too? It's like New York audiences want to see a Hypocrites.
I guess the question is, where would they do it? What theater would they do that? Ars Nova.
Well, they would want to do a new show. I don't think they want to do one of their touring shows at... Ars Nova would be great for them to do a new show.
If you're a Chicago-based theater, how do you develop a new show in New York, though?
I don't know. Ask Sean Graney.
You know, I don't. I mean, the New York is not the imprimatur of everything. It's just I'm selfishly want to see the damn shows. You know,
we're at ART. That's not far away.
When Rude Mex came to town before they went to Lincoln Center, where did they perform?
Oh God, I did a Method Gun. It was somewhere downtown.
Maybe the Abrams or something.
But wasn't the production they did at Lincoln Center a new production that they then toured after it debuted at Lincoln Center?
Oh, they haven't toured Stop Hearing Yourself yet.
But it started at Lincoln Center.
Yeah, it did. But Lincoln Center commissioned it.
It was a commission.
So maybe someone should commission the Hypocrites.
Lincoln Center,
maybe
give the Hypocrites a lot of money.
The thing I'm excited about that didn't get enough press, but someone tweeted it out that they're going to do the Chicago premiere of American Idiot. The Hypocrites.
That'll be an amazing idea.
Yeah, yeah.
What?
I don't have a date,
but I was on Twitter, so I believe it.
That's interesting that they're doing it.
If it's on Twitter,
because
when I
interviewed Sean Graney about the Gilbert and Sullivan pieces, he talked a lot about how they wanted to use musicals that were in the
public domain,
mm-hmm. so that they could make changes. Tweets.
Well, American
Idiot
is in the public domain. No, just kidding.
American Idiot is very much not in the public domain, so they have less freedom with the text than the Hypocrites generally like to have.
I should probably confirm that story, which is just on Twitter. But I retweeted it, and people were excited about it, so it must be true. I think we already see some possible favorites for our top 10 list. This is too early to say. I think I had Akhtar's Disgraced. Going to be at Berkeley Rep, going to be at the Goodman, am I right? Going back to Chicago?
Yes.
That's at least two places. I think I saw it a couple other.
I'm pretty sure I wrote up Disgrace a couple times.
And Laura Easton's Sex with Strangers. I didn't see as mm-hmm. much, but, you know, that's a two-hander. It's got sex in the title. It also happens to be a really great play. That's one that I think when she wrote it, I did a big piece on her for American Theater. And, you know, she admitted that there was some calculation in writing a play called Sex with Strangers that has two people in it. Like, if it's any good and people gets a good production as it did here at Second Stage, it's going to be done a lot.
I think Pierre Marx put on Facebook or Twitter that his review of Sex with Strangers has gotten like the most hits of anything he's ever written.
I imagine
because of Google searches.
The Google search terms for that.
The review on when I used to work at a different magazine, and our review of a show called I won't use the actual word. We reviewed a show called Effing Girls. And that was our top hit story on the whole site.
Yeah.
All the time.
Thank you, Internet Pervert.
James and Giant Peach is coming to a ton of places, which is not necessarily a play, but
it's a play.
For young audiences.
We also include those on our list. You know, Cat in the Hat, the Katie Mitchell version of that was on our list a couple years ago. And
this year.
Was it this year?
Mm-hmm.
Last year.
Peter and the Starcatcher was on last year. And, you know, that's not for children, but it's not really a musical per se, is it?
It's
but
it's play
got
with
lots
music.
Of music.
Well, Blade Bloody's been on it.
Yeah, I mean,
so we don't distinguish between musicals and plays.
Well, it's a
for
theater for young audiences piece, but I think it's been I've seen it on a ton of TYA theaters.
Yeah. We got Bridges at two places now.
Well, it's on tour.
I think that's going to be I don't think that's going to be on the top 10. But anyway, who knows?
But are they part of the
Cast
tour
your votes
or are
now.
They separate? Bridges is launching a tour.
I don't know if Arkansas Rep is doing a tour of it. You know, anyway.
Can't you not stage a regional production if there's a national tour going on from the Broadway production?
Oh, I think they make all kinds of different deals. There was I can't remember the show. There was one that exact thing happened. 39 Steps is one.
Okay.
That had a tour and there were regional productions licensed at the same time.
I've never heard of that happening.
Yeah.
Before.
And it got a little confusing because I think in some markets there were productions that patrons were like, which one should I go to? Because they could drive, you know, an hour to one way.
Well, that's the reason not to do regional productions while you have a tour going on is because you don't want to create competition.
39 Steps coming back to Off-Broadway.
Yep.
Arnie Burton. Anyway. Anything else we need to say about the exciting seasons coming up?
Lots of good stuff so far.
We're almost putting our April issue to bed, right?
It's falls asleep today.
Falls asleep today.
Ooh, MCC. I'm really excited for that only because it's a bunch of shows that we've covered before and they're finally coming to New York,
Matthew
so I
Lopez,
can see them.
Legend of Georgina McBride. What was the other one?
Georgia McBride, Nora Hadel's Smokefall.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm excited about Smokefall.
Huh?
I'm excited about that one.
Oh, I'm really excited. I saw the reading of it like 3 years ago and it made me cry.
Where?
South Coast Rep. They did the first reading of it, and then they did the first production. It was a really difficult play to stage, also. There's just a lot of magical realism, and the second act is two fetuses singing Sondheim in utero.
Wow.
It,
That sounds like my kind of show.
I know. I love the hell out of that play. And I've never seen a production of it.
I'm actually really excited about Playwrights Horizon season.
Yes, The Christians.
Christians is finally coming to New York, which is.
But what's
incredible.
Interesting is that there's a production in Chicago at a Hyde Park Theater that's of The Christians right now.
Really?
Yes.
Isn't there one coming up in L.A. or did it already happen?
Yes. No, it's coming up in L.A.
Les Waters directing that.
Taper or the Douglas?
Oh, geez.
Anyway, it's at CTG, one of their three spaces. It's not the Amundsen.
And I mean, here is coming to Playwrights, which I'm excited about.
Taylor Mack, yeah.
And Marjorie Prime, Jordan Harrison's play, which I read and did a piece on for us, and it's.
I feel duty
really
bound
good.
To mention that here is now playing at Mixed Blood in Minneapolis. So.
Yes.
Another member theater.
Taylor had good things to say about the production, according to his Facebook feed.
Good.
He didn't say you.
He did not say you. Unlike what he said about our piece about Bill Pullman playing Othello.
Bill Pullman's Othello, yeah, that was an insightful comment. I think we have a great issue you should look forward to, and keep checking online as the seasons get updated. And now I think we'll go to our interview with Eliza Bent. So Eliza Jane Bent, this is the room I think I met you in.
That's right.
The blue room and when I interviewed for the job. Now, what year did you start, 2007?
I started in 2006.
2006?
Yeah.
Wow. I don't remember ever asking you where you came from when you started this job. Where are you coming from?
Pardon me. I had been working in a very different sector. I was an editorial assistant at Elle Magazine. Not the L magazine of Brooklyn, which people often would say, oh my God, what a funny job. And then I would say, no, it was an even funnier job.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And I worked there when the Devil Wears Prada came out. So
Wow. It
was very apropos.
Was that film pretty accurate to your experience?
The film was frighteningly accurate.
Wow.
I remember going to, I got like a little special invitation to like, to the assistant of Anne Slowey. She was my boss.
Yeah.
And there was this pre-screening for like all of New York's fabulous assistants, interns, etc. And so I went to this screening with a lot of other young white women that were kind of teetering in high heels and slinky dresses. And I remember them laughing, the audience laughing. And I remember being on the edge of my seat, gripping the arm rests because it was so accurate. And
Right. It
was so close to home.
So now it makes me sad that there's been no film version of editorial life at American Theater you can compare it to. Has there, or?
Gosh, there has certainly been no artistic thing that I have made or know of that has in any way shaped in any way ricochets off of American Theater. No.
Fast forwarding to now. Now were you a playwright then? A produced playwright? So in the 9 years, almost 9 years you've worked here, you've got an MFA from Brooklyn College as a playwright.
Yeah.
You've had many plays produced. You've acted in many plays. You've toured the world with plays.
Well, sure, yes.
Yeah.
I have done that.
And you've toured the world covering theater for American Theater.
Yeah, I've had a good run.
Yeah.
Had a really good run.
I was looking back at some of the places, and I probably don't have them all. One of the first stories that drew my attention, because it was the one that, when I started here, was that cover of the Latvian Streetcar.
Totally.
It was such a great
cover.
It's the kind of thing where, it's not great for audio, but it's like some folks in a colorful bathroom wearing sort of hipster thrift shop clothes. You would not think, like, oh, that's Streetcar, right?
Right. She's in a bathtub.
She's in a bathtub and he's like tying his tie or something. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, I sort of had like a backwards education with theater because that was the first Streetcar Named Desire I ever saw.
Wow.
And it was in Latvian, in Riga.
Yeah.
And they didn't have sir titles of screens. They had in ear.
Oh.
Which in some ways I kind of prefer sometimes.
Yeah.
When I'm seeing international non-English based theater, I prefer the in ear sometimes. I feel kind of pretentious saying that.
Yeah.
But it was a cool thing because I was hearing all of these like lines from the zeitgeist, because I had also never read A Streetcar Named Desire. So I was hearing, you know, the kindness always depends on strangers. And
right.
The woman had the in-ear woman had a really strong accent, so then he would call out, Stelle! And she'd say, Stella. Stelle! Stella. And all of these different, like, famous lines were in this delightfully Eastern European accented English.
Was she giving you the exact Tennessee Williams, or an adaptation of Tennessee Williams? Sir?
It was straight up Tennessee Williams.
Wow.
They probably made a few cuts, but
yeah,
like,
sure.
These were his lines that were being said in Latvian and then in English with a Latvian accent in my ear.
That.
And it was a very small, intimate theater, so you could see everything on stage. It was like a long, shallow theater that they probably usually use the theater in other ways, but they had reversed it, so the audience was like in two really long rows, and the actors were just stalking about. And of course, she, you know, the woman who plays
Blanche right.
is some famous soap opera actress and television star. And
right.
They were all, you know, very distinguished actors,
yeah,
but
yeah.
you could see like his neck muscle popping out.
Wow. Latvia was just one of many Eastern European countries. Eastern Europe seems to have been a place that you went to Poland.
I did go to Poland, yep. oh boy, did I. I went to Poland, I went to Hungary, and
right.
I went to Latvia in
right.
my tenure year. That's in reverse order.
Right.
Those trips, yeah.
And you saw lots of international theater. You also saw a lot of international theater here. It would be fair to say that was one of your foci here, focuses, was international work.
I like international work a lot.
Right.
Yeah.
The other thing that you did while you were here was, I don't know when strategies started, but you are one of the few people at this magazine who's had a regular column.
Yeah.
On a particular topic.
Yeah.
And it's a fixture we're going to keep going, and you're going to keep writing for us.
Totally, absolutely. Yeah, it was a funny thing how it all began, because
tell me how it began.
Was kind of the brainchild in some ways of, I think, Teresa. I think Teresa kind of dreamed it
Teresa
up.
Iring,
Teresa
Iring, our executive director, yeah.
Our leader.
Yeah.
So, she had been talking about this idea of, like, getting something to do with best practices
in the
magazine, and I don't think it's a secret. I think some of the other editors were saying, kind of grumbling, like, we have so much on our plates. How are we going to cover this? And how can we cover this in a way that's not just like, go theater, but something that actually, you know, talks about things. So me being the bright, at that time, bright, shiny new person.
Yeah,
I think it was like a year or a year and a half, 2 years into my tenure here, but I was like, I'm hungry, I'll do it, I'll do anything, give me anything to write.
Right.
And so, yeah, so we sort of came up with this, decided to call it Strategies, and I've written the lion's share of them. And that first one, gosh, I can't even remember what it was about, but I remember daring to do something crazy, and like I had plays speak lines of dialogue, and I remember Sarah Hart laughing out loud. I remember being really proud of that.
Well, I'm looking back at the archive.
Yeah.
Was it the one about the National New Play Network?
It must have been that
one.
Yeah, the very first one. And I think it was like, you know, I've had 3 productions at regional theaters now, said XYZ play by XYZ playwright. And it was like so silly, but it worked. I don't know. I hope it worked.
It
was a fun. I've written one in Twitter language.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, let's see. Do you have it? You have it here. Let's pull it up.
Well, I like that at the end of the column, it says Strategies is a new column featuring initiatives relating to theater finance, marketing, fundraising, education, to audience development, governance, architecture, and artistry. That's
pretty much everything.
That's a lot.
A new column related to theater, we should have said, probably.
Right. Let's allow the plays to speak for themselves. I've had 6 productions at NNPN member theaters and 18 productions at non-NNPN theaters, declares Thomas Gibbons' permanent collection.
Great.
Woo! Wow, that's an innovation
in itself.
That's
a lot of productions.
That is, yeah, no. And Yeah, I didn't realize that was the first strategy you did. I mean, you covered everything from as it says, fundraising strategies, casting approaches,
sure.
Approaches to what's the digital Bible of the stage Bible. You did
yep,
that one.
Did yeah. not write that one.
Okay,
but
right.
someone else wrote it.
But that's the kind of things we covered in strategies.
Green theater practices. How to be a better actor, how to be a more working actor, how to write more plays or write plays
yeah.
differently. What's been cool about it is that it's kind of run the gamut of, like, best practices for, like, larger institutional regional theaters, but also for pretty small theaters and for individual artists,
right.
which has been really fun to, like, walk the line of, like, what does a best practice even mean?
Right. I mean, it's a rich area because I think all of us have had ideas and others of us have written strategies on occasion.
Sure, yeah.
Because it's basically anything that theaters or theater artists do could be a strategy.
I think in the sense that, like, it can be replicated.
Right, exactly.
In the sense that it can be boiled down of, like, this was the challenge that we were seeing. This is the plan that we decided to, like, address that challenge, like
right.
fun initiative or practice, whatever
right. Right.
you're calling it, and then like getting into the nitty-gritties of how it works. But right. also one of the big, and I don't know how successful it's been thus far in that, but one of the big ideas with the strategies was to not just talk about like, yay, go theater, this is amazing, but to talk about the challenges within the,
right.
the practice.
Right.
So what hasn't worked? What have you changed over the years?
Mm-hmm.
What's been a failure? And how have you gone about addressing that?
Right, right. I mean,
so yeah.
And even given the fact that a lot of these strategies are created to address something that's wrong or something that doesn't seem right,
sure.
and then they come up with their own challenges once they're in action. So yeah, no, it's a great column. And you know, it's funny that's sort of the nuts and bolts side of Eliza's writing. I mean, and not that you haven't done that with other things, but you've also covered like the aesthetics and artistry
sure.
of theater artists. Really well throughout your
Thanks,
tenure.
Ralph.
I remember some of the big features you did were kind of strategies-esque, right? In the sense that the awards
Those
ones...
Those were the ones they let me write.
Well, yes, I know. I mean, for instance, the one about awards, which is like no one has done a story that I've ever read about national... Just looking at all across the country theater awards.
Well, I remember when I first got here getting press releases and... I was, you know, it's like you look back and it's like, oh, what a silly young person I was. But I remember being absolutely flabbergasted and rolling my eyes at, like, the bajillion awards
yeah.
that me,
yeah.
having come, not having a very particularly strong theater background, having just come off fresh off the heels of working at Elle magazine,
right, right.
where it was, like, a totally different sector, but being like, why are there so many awards? I've never even heard of this playwright.
Right, right.
I mean, granted, I had heard of, like, 5 living playwrights when I started working here.
Right, right.
Truly, like, I did not have a theater background.
Right,
and
right.
So I was, like, very perplexed and flummoxed at the girth of these awards and the self-seriousness of course, it's a press release. Now it's completely second nature. But at the time, I was very, very intrigued and amazed.
Yeah.
And I was like, who cares? Why, you know... This person got an award, but has anyone ever heard of this playwright?
Right, right. Or let alone...
Or this award
show,
for that matter?
Right, exactly.
And, you know, but it was really good that in many ways that it took a few years to actually end up writing that article, because by then I think I had a hopefully more nuanced understanding of why all of these awards exist. And now that I'm on the other side of actually considering myself a playwright,
mm-hmm.
Gosh, it's nice to have a...
I mean, yeah, I think, you know, obviously theater is ephemeral and it's not super materially rewarding, so awards are one way to mark, like, this was good, I did it, you know, so, but yeah, I think my favorite, this is sort of recent because that's just what I remember, was the one about older actors and older...
Oh, yeah.
What do we call that? What was our term for senior citizen theater?
Seniors in theater acting.
Theater. And whether it was in experimental work, the main show that you considered, the one that was at the Chocolate Factory.
Oh, yeah. That was directed by Mallory Catlett.
Right, right.
Who is not a senior citizen.
No.
But used actors that were in... But you're right. It had a talking band member. Paul Zimmet, I think.
That's what it
is.
Yeah.
And, that was a really cool story.
So everything from that to, you know, senior citizens doing Fiddler on the Roof. like acting out all
kinds
of that.
It was a sort of like hugely broad topic that I tried to whittle down into something. But yeah, what it came down to was I realized like, oh, there's stuff that we at the magazine would consider more professional, but
yeah.
then there's this huge amount of theater being done by amateur groups
yeah.
and community yeah. groups that are involving people that have either never done theater or have always done theater on a kind of community level, amateur level of interest.
Right, which is an area that we don't tend to cover, but what I liked about it was you weren't covering the trade of it. You talked about how people do it and how... But it was, I don't know, just it was about the substance of why theater... It was a beautiful story because it was about what theater does for people and what it the soul of theater, I thought.
The soul and the spirit. It was absolutely that, because I think part of one of the beats that I think you have often towed some interest in is theater for children.
Yeah.
You
yeah,
have
yeah.
two youngins
yeah,
at
yeah,
home.
Exactly.
And, you know, Nicole Estevanik was all often, Nicole Estevanik Taylor,
yeah.
was often pointing out, hey guys, we really never cover all that much children's theater.
Yeah,
Theater for young audiences. And
yeah.
so, yeah, I remember once again sort of like looking at these press releases that I get and thinking, man, I'd gotten like, I don't know, 3 or 4 press releases about senior-specific related theater. And I thought, wow, we never talk about theater for older people. And so it just seemed like a cool chance to maybe... I think like the tagline that I had worked out with you was like, what does it mean when we talk about senior theater? Like, what does that even mean? What
right.
does that look like?
Yeah, well, the cliche is that we're talking about the audiences are old, right? But what about... You know,
oh, that wasn't even really so much a part of it.
No, I know, but I think that when people think of old people in theater, they think like, oh yeah, the people we do theater for. No, these are people doing theater.
Sure.
What does it... I especially thought it was a great sort of counterintuitive story because this field chases youth so much. We're not Hollywood, but we still, like, there's all these awards for people under 30 and, like, for young emerging playwrights, and there's a lot of concern about mid-career people, but I just feel like... I was happy that you took up that, you know, that mission to write that story.
Cool.
I realize you did great Q&As with you know, all sorts of folks, Brandon, Jacob Jenkins, and Romeo Castellucci, and I've sort of Young Gene Lee. I've talked a lot.
Mark Russell.
Were there highlights that you can recall in your time here?
Gosh.
Was there a story or was
I'm
there
smiling with terror highlights?
Was there either a story in how it turned out that you especially loved, or just the reporting experience that you thought was amazing, like your trips to Austin or your
Well, all of the international stuff, whether it was in Montreal or mm-hmm. Iceland, was amazing because
right.
that's the coolest thing to do. To get to travel for
yep.
theater is awesome.
Yeah.
And it exposes you to see, like, oh my gosh, there's a totally different way of making theater. Like, when I went to Iceland was the very first trip that I went on, and it was this totally kind of, like, spur-of-the-moment, last-minute, like, I had written to a bunch of festivals being like, hey, I'm really interested in covering you, and I work for a not-for-profit,
mm-hmm.
in my Kermit voice or whatever that voice is that I just used. But I was, like, so green, you know, and I was just interested, and was sort of inspired by some of the other folks here that had gone on international festivals, and so I'd written to a bunch of places and expressed interest, and so this festival in Iceland said, sure, you can come, we'll pay for you, for your ticket, and if you write something about the festival. So this one play I remember seeing in Iceland, it was such a bizarre out-of-body experience, being there by your own, or on your own, and there wasn't like the festivals have a really different way of bringing in artists, so
yeah.
this was a very much of like a solo voyage, and I had never traveled on my own either, so that was sort of interesting. But one of the shows that I saw was on this huge boat in a harbor, and it was this feminist piece of theater. I can't even recall anything more about it beyond the fact that it was feminist and super site-specific on this huge boat.
Wow.
And at the end, the audience gathered in this sort of inner deck room, and they were showing a movie, but then a wall went up, like a garage door, raised up. We went outside onto the deck, and a helicopter came and took the actors up in the helicopter. I mean, like, you would never see that anywhere else.
No.
Nowhere else has the money
right.
or the infrastructure
right.
to deal with something like a helicopter.
Right.
So, you know, that was, like, hugely formative of, like, wow, like, in other... Or like maybe you could do that in the United States. I can't imagine a regional theater jumping at the chance to like involve a helicopter in a show. But like, yeah, or like seeing fire on stage in Hungary.
Right.
Like there's just like they just they're people do different stuff in other places, and that's like maddeningly and delightfully inspiring in a certain sense. In Austin, I saw a show that was done as a drive-in.
Okay.
There's like different places have like different amounts of space, and so that's been pretty cool.
Right, it's been inspiring to you as a journalist, but also as an artist, obviously.
Oh, as a human being, I
right.
mean, unfortunately, I occupy both those roles.
Right.
Journalist and artist, which I know is like a really unfashionable, bad thing to be.
No, not at all. Not at all. It does raise questions for people, right?
For sure.
Right.
Well, that's part of, I think, why I've always tried to stick more to writing about the nuts and bolts, because I think it's hard. Well, certainly the magazine doesn't review things.
No, no.
We don't write critically about art.
No, but I especially
it's a fraught topic.
Well, yes,
but
you know, you wrote that recent piece of whether you looked at Romeo's Four Seasons restaurant
sure.
and the Nassim Soleimanpour
yeah.
White Rabbit, Red Rabbit, was it called?
Yeah, yeah.
The right colors
totally.
Earlier there, but where you could consider things critically, but not you're not out to go. This wasn't good, I didn't like this, I like this.
Right,
it wasn't
right.
It wasn't reviews.
I know, even the way we talk about theater is so hard because, like, we'll say we can't write about things critically, but then we like to at least think critically, hopefully,
yeah,
with our articles. Yeah, that was a fun thing to write about.
Was there any... I was also wondering whether there was any...
domestic?
Reporting experience that included, like, wild personalities that you've spoken to that just...
Well, okay, I would have to say by far one of my favorite... reporting experiences was shadowing Mark Russell.
Okay.
The idea
yeah.
with that was, you know, I'm a really big fan of The New Yorker,
right.
and I always really love pieces that have like a durational element to them, where
right.
it's like
we're clearly
like more than one interview happening,
yeah.
and
yeah.
for whatever reason we get so crazy busy here, and I think often it's like we forget that we can ask that of people,
yeah,
and
sure.
so I remember like. Pretty much like pitching the idea to the folks at the Public and saying, you know, we want to like actually shadow him and like spend more than 1 hour with him.
Right.
And they were like, okay, that's weird. And I remember like getting into a room with Mark Russell to basically like sell him on the idea.
Right.
And he was so funny and disarming and
yeah.
like, you know, oh God, I'm loose at the mouth or something of that nature, like saying that he often, speaks off the cuff, and of
right.
course this was like gold to like a little journalist's ears, but it was cool because I got to see him in really different contexts in his office
right.
talking with Universes, a group in New York
right.
and then also talking with a Polish funder, like those are two like totally different conversations that he was having, and then also getting to see theater with him
right.
I think we had like yeah like 3 or 4 like hangouts or whatever
okay.
and it wasn't over the course of months, it was over the course of I don't know 2 or 2.5 weeks
right, right,
so it was
right.
compressed, but it was still really really fun to get to like I don't know, I felt like I got a really good sense of who he was as a person, who
uh-huh.
he was as a curator, as a leader of a festival
right.
and just like a man of theater and like
right.
what made him tick and what got him excited and jazzed.
And that was after Under the Radar Festival, which he curates, moved from, it used to be just at PS122, right? And then it moved to the Public.
Yeah,
yeah.
I don't think it was ever at PS122. He had been
oh, he was at
the leader of PS122.
Okay. But Under the Radar was always a Public initiative?
It was,
or not?
I can't even, I would have to reread the article.
Right, right,
but
right.
I think that it was his brainchild
right,
with this
of
idea of APAP happening in New York I think it might have even started off with St. Anne's in some
Yeah, that rings a bell. That rings a bell.
But
we're so well informed here. That sounds amazing.
Go back to the archives.
That sounds amazing. It was funny you were saying.
We should do more of that. Like, especially for those of us that live in New York and when we're covering people in New York.
Right. No, it's funny.
It's just hard to organize and plan, you know?
You were saying we can, you know, we forget that we can ask those people. We also forget we can ask that of ourselves because we're so busy here.
Well, now that I'm a freelancer, maybe I can pitch some stories like that.
Maybe. The other thing that you're going to do for us.
I did that a little bit too with Brandon Jacobs Jenkins. I had
two
separate
interviews
with him.
Yeah.
Which was great.
The other thing you're going to keep writing for us is the love column, as we're calling it.
I'm going to keep writing strategies, and I'm definitely going to keep writing the love column.
Well, this is to explain to our listeners.
Oh, yes.
It's based. We have love columns not exist yet, but you did a big piece in the January issue of
February issue.
Sorry, of for
time
for
to Valentine's
Day. Yes,
that's the only reason I remember it.
No. I get mixed up which month it is because of our schedule or production schedule. But
what year is it?
In which you talked about couples who work together, not just couples. You know, theatrical couples who actually work together. There are plenty of theatrical couples who don't work together, but these are ones who do. They direct. One's a player. What?
You just made a funny expression on your face.
Did I?
I wanted to say that that was such a cool piece, if I may. I felt that was a really fun piece because it was something that I had always kind of had in the back of my brain.
Yeah.
And then I remember talking with the folks that run a group called 600 Highwaymen, the Obie Award-winning group led by Michael Silverstone and Abigail Browdy. And they were kind of jokingly saying, like, God, when are you going to write a piece about couples in the theater? When are you going to... And then they were kind of... The joke actually turned into, like a real, considered conversation.
Yeah.
They themselves are a couple, and I wrote about them in the piece. But it was, like, this thing of, oh, shit, like, there's so many examples.
Yeah.
And it is kind of crazy that it's never... That if we talk about it, it's either like, you know, fluffy, shocky, like, ooh, like this is how they met, not actually talking about the like the nitty gritties of like the joys and hardships and the multi layered, complicated aspects of what it is to make work with your partner.
What I loved about that piece as with a lot of your best pieces is that
praise me, Rob.
Me. That's the hook of it, but I feel like. That's just one way to talk about the stuff that all theaters deal with, the collaboration.
Yeah, whether or
really
not you're in a
level.
Relationship
Yeah, exactly.
Or not. Totally.
I would love that piece. So you're gonna, in addition to freelancing for us, Eliza, you're gonna be making theater in the next few months.
God.
What should we look for? Should we not talk about that?
We
or
can
you wanna...
talk about it. Sure. I mean, yeah, I'll be making theater. It was a ripe moment. I feel to switch. To go from senior editor to, I don't know, editor at large or ongoing freelancer.
Right.
Editor at large is always like the strangest.
It makes it sound like you're out there in the
it's
wild
kind of
and we're hunting
spooky.
You. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah,
I feel like I need to wear like a bandana or something or like a, I don't know, some kind
it's
of hiking.
Like an outlaw.
Hiking outfit.
But
yeah, no, the idea is that I'm going to be teaching a couple things. I am teaching some stuff right now at Brooklyn College.
Okay.
And I have a couple productions in the spring and then one in the summer. And so, yeah, that'll be fun to work on those things.
Well, we'll look
and
for
the thing in the summer is cool because the class that I'm teaching right now at Brooklyn College is basically serving as a development petri dish of ideas for this commission in August.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Cool. Eliza, it's going to be a huge loss. And
the Chinese character for... Oh, God. Who is selling this to me? They were saying, there's somebody who's saying the Chinese character for challenge is the same as the Chinese character for opportunity.
Well, that makes sense.
Which,
yeah.
Then he was saying, I have just made that up. But he would say, Mike Mikos, that devilish soul.
Yeah.
But yeah, I feel like this is a really exciting time to hopefully do more articles like the Mark Russell piece that I just cited, where you get to like shadow somebody for more than than 55 minutes.
And so well, this is not, you're not leaving this, this is just a new chapter of your relationship with
American
theater.
It's not goodbye, it's a see you later. You know,
that's
I'll
great.
Still come into Manhattan every now and then.
You'd be, you know, the other title we could give you is Editor Emeritus. You know, that means like...
Ooh! Like, I like Emeritus,
up,
but
yeah.
I also really like At Large. Like,
well, maybe
it really makes
large.
Me feel like a bandit.
Well, Liza, we wish you the best in your
Thanks, Rob.
Theater banditry and your journalism.
It was really fun to look back on my 8.5 years here with you.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And we're back with some recommendations, endorsements, whatever you want to call them, of things that we like that you should know about. Deep, you want to start?
Sure. My recommendation is The Sound of Music Companion from Universe Press. We got this beautiful thing in the office, and Rob doesn't like The Sound of Music for some odd reason, and he usually gets all the books, but then he gave it to me, so I'm going to take it home and put it on my coffee table because it's a very handsome coffee table size book, and to commemorate the 50th anniversary of The Sound of Music film, and it basically a lot of full-blown photos of the cast and backstage photos of Julie Andrews, and there's a foreword by Julie as well, and an inexplicably large photo of Carrie Underwood.
Which, what?
Yeah, towards the back.
Well, she did play Maria in
yeah,
Sound
did.
Music Live.
Oh, yeah, that mm-hmm. one? Yeah.
Yep.
Where?
On page 178.
Well, they had to talk about Sound of Music Live.
Yep.
Let me take a look at this book here. And what was the other book? There was another Sound of Music book came in.
Yes, though I'm not taking that one home, I don't
okay.
think. It won't be as nicely set in my musical theater themed apartment. So, but
you have a musical theater themed apartment?
Not yet, but I'm planning on redecorating. It's going to be all playbills all the time.
There's Mary Martin, the original.
Yep, and a photo of Miss Piggy and Kermit doing it too.
Great.
So it's a bunch of beautiful images, some
inside
stories.
It would only
stories.
Be complete if they preprinted Pauline Kael's review titled "The Sound of Money," which sums up my point of view. Susie, what do you have to recommend?
I'm going to recommend. It's not a theater related per se, but it has a lot of theater shout outs and theater industry people in it. I and Deep also. I think she hates me a little bit for getting to recommend this. Are very obsessed with the Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. Tina Fey and Robert Carlock's new TV show, which is on Netflix. It's hilarious. It is about a young woman named Kimmy Schmidt who has been trapped in an underground apocalypse cult for 15 years. And she gets out and moves to New York City and moves in with Titus Burgess of Broadway fame, who plays Titus Andromedon.
Titus with one S.
Titus with one S. It's kind of like the Tracy Jordan, Tracy Morgan model from 30 Rock, wherein he plays an out-of-work gay musical theater actor who's struggling. And so it's kind of a riff on himself. He sings songs such as Pinot Noir and I Will Kill the Spider-Man in their Spider-Man 2, spelled T-O-O.
Oh my God.
Too many Spider-Men.
Just so you know, James Monroe Iglehart, Tony Winner from Aladdin, is also in that episode auditioning for Spider-Man 2, Too Many Spider-Men. They write a classic musical called Daddy's Boy, which has Jefferson Mays and Nick Rouleau, and they've shot it in black and white, so it looks like a classic musical.
Oh my
Jeff
God.
Richmond, Tina Fey's husband, also the music supervisor and executive producer on the show. He also did the theme music for 30 Rock, as well as, you know, all the great songs from 30 Rock, Muffin Top, and all those songs.
And they're working on a Mean Girls musical.
And they're working on a Mean Girls musical, and after hearing all the very addictive... very addictive songs in Kimmy Schmidt. I cannot wait for the Mean Girls musical because Jeff Richmond is a musical genius. Anyway, Kimmy Schmidt is hilarious. It's so quotable. It's very, very hilarious. And Titus Burgess is, you know, he's going to get an Emmy nomination. He's so funny in it.
So have you binged on the whole show already?
I've finished the whole series. 13 episodes. They're about 23 minutes each.
Yeah, you can binge it in 6 hours, basically.
And you can watch it a second time and find new things. I'm already on my second time around and catching new one-liners and new jokes.
Both Susie and I binged it in, like, less than a couple days. It was It was a good weekend.
But it, like, employs a lot of the theater community. John Olsen Conley also has a bit in it.
Christine Ebersole
has a bit. Carol Kane is a series regular as well. She plays the crazy landlord, wannabe crack dealer. She's hilarious. Ellie Kemper plays Kimmy Schmidt. And as Rob pointed out, she has UCB training
UCB
background.
UCB training background, whatever. I believe here in New York.
Yeah.
And it's they a great shoot cast. Here in New York, too. That's why there's so many.
We have a New York theater
musical.
Link to that. Well, that sounds great. I plan to get there. I am still making my way through Breaking Bad. That shows you how behind I am on the world.
We have two sons. We're single people.
And they love Breaking Bad. No, just kidding.
Oh my God.
I have just, these aren't necessarily recommendations, but things I'm sort of excited about, nervously excited about. As you probably all know, if you're a regular listener, one of my favorite shows that's still running of this season is Our Town. Not Our Town. On the Town. That was a funny slip. On the Town.
Rob loves Our Town.
Because
who doesn't?
Our Town, the musical. No, On the Town. And in part because, you know, it evokes, it's great, it's a great show. But it evokes for me some of my favorite cultural artifacts of any period in any medium, which are the MGM musicals of the 50s, the color, Technicolor movies by Stanley Donen and Vincent Minnelli, Singing in the Rain, Bandwagon, so on. But and what's great about it also is the ballet in it, because there's these huge dream ballets, which is another signature of some of those old MGM movies. Well, I'm a little too excited, and probably will be let down, but American in Paris and Gigi are both coming to Broadway. And American in Paris played at, was it the Comédie Française in, is that right? Anyway, at a big French theater.
We ran an article about it.
And Gigi played out of town in Washington. Where was it again?
A Kennedy Center.
Kennedy Center, yes. Anyway, so there's that nonprofit, that tenuous nonprofit link. What's fascinating to me, I'll just make this as brief as I can, American in Paris 51, Gigi 58, they're like the bookends of Vincent Minnelli's peak career. They both take place in Paris. They're both like faux French. I'm a much bigger fan of Gigi actually than American in Paris, although I think on stage I'm probably going to enjoy American in Paris more. It's got Christopher Wheeldon, who's an amazing choreographer, doing his directorial choreography debut. Gigi I know very little about, other than someone named Vanessa Hutchins. Is she a Disney star or something? What is she?
High School Musical.
I'm looking at you, Dave, because I figure it's your generation, right? No?
I was too old for High School Musical.
Okay.
Corey Cott.
Whoever that is. Anyway, I
Newsies.
Am excited about those productions because, you know, most... I won't go into my reasons for not liking Sound of Music, but I don't tend to like film adaptations of stage musicals. They don't tend to work for me. The musicals I love the most on film are the ones created for the screen, which Gigi was, and American Paris was, Singing in the Rain, and so on, because they're created cinematically and they just work better.
And Cinderella is made for TV.
Yeah, that's not my favorite piece of anything. I couldn't say enough about it. Anyway, I'm looking forward to those two. I will go back into my musical film nerd paradise if they're both even half as good as On the Town. So that's my recommendation, yes?
Oh, and a fun fact I recently discovered. So Megan Fairchild, who plays Miss Turnstile in On the Town.
Her brother.
Yeah.
It's like ballet's coming back to Broadway.
No, right. I think that's a positive development. Again, you can't do those giant overproduced dream ballets without, you know, actual ballet people.
Oh, I know you and Eliza talked about it the last podcast, but this was before Susie and I could get in on the Hamilton.
Oh gosh,
fun!
What's
Hamilton is great.
This is what
we didn't see until last
Hamil
week.
What?
It's like,
Hamilton
what? It's like, what is Hamilton?
Yeah. No, it's good. You like it?
Deep sighs.
Was the expectation overraised? I don't think you can raise expectations too high.
I said the expectations were met, not exceeded, because they were pretty high.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, it was one of those rare times.
When people tell you it's the best thing they've ever seen, it's going to change musical theater, that is a hard expectation
I don't know if it's the best thing I ever saw, but I do think it's going to change musical theater.
It was pretty life-changing, I do have to admit, though. It could be tightened. For anyone, background information, this is Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton, which is at the Public Theater, and it's going to be on Broadway.
July 13th, previews August 8th, opening?
It opens August 6th, previews July 13th.
Okay.
I think.
But for any actors who want to be in Hamilton, the casting notice just came out today for the Broadway run, the principal call, and all multi-ethnic cast, it specifies for every main character aside from King George, which if you see the musical, you would get why he needs to be Caucasian. But every other character, it specified non-white. So actors of color who can sing and rap and do hip-hop and all that fun stuff, get the
It's like quadruple threat.
Well,
sing, dance,
I mean,
act, and
the
rap.
Equity casting call is pretty much a formality and a legal consideration. You have to have an equity principal casting call if you have a show coming to Broadway, but I'm sure the entire public cast is moving.
Yeah, indeed.
So,
but I think one of the strengths of the show that I can't talk about enough is that it's going to make stars of whoever replaces these people because it's...
Or these people.
Well, these people, sure. Of course. But the roles are strong enough that, as I think, I think Javier, I've heard, is even better than Lin-Manuel.
Yeah, Javier's great.
As Hamilton. And I think that part is going to be around forever. And
yeah, and whenever it gets to the not-for-profit regional circuit, then it will be great roles for any young actors of color.
Indeed. I think on that upbeat note, we will leave another off script. Thank you for listening.